Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Manchester is Red podcast with myself, Tyrone Marshall, hosting this week in the absence of Stephen Railston, who is enjoying himself and making some money, hopefully, at Cheltenham, and in the permanent now absence of Rich Fay, who you may have seen has left the MEN for pastures new and a potential rival organisation, so we won't mention them, and this is the last that Rich Fay will ever be mentioned on this podcast. But Samuel, you are still with us. How are you doing today?
I'm not doing too bad at all, thank you very much. It is a shame that Rich is going, although I would say he's gone to a non-rival as it stands. I wouldn't quite put them in our slipstream just yet, but maybe there'll be a power struggle in Manchester one day.
Yeah, I think we're away from that. I think I called him a potential rival, which is maybe as generous as it's going to get. With all due respect to Rich and his colleagues over there at the unnamed organisation, let's not give them any help in trying to bridge that gap. But there will still be podcasts going forward. We're here today to preview another massive game this weekend. Liverpool in the FA Cup quarterfinal start to be a huge run for United. It's one of those fixtures that gets the juices flowing whenever United are playing Liverpool, but an FA Cup quarterfinal at Old Trafford with what feels like so much on the line for both teams. It's a really exciting, tantalising fixture, isn't it, Samuel?
It's the first FA Cup quarterfinal between the teams, and the history between the clubs in general obviously is immense, but even in the FA Cup, there's a really rich history there. Of course, there was the 77 final, there's been the 96 final, the fourth round tie in 99 was probably the day that everyone heard the word treble used for the first time in English football, and the possibility of United doing the treble, which of course they did. But that was the day where the belief really, really started to permeate throughout the club. And there have been other great FA Cup ties. I mean, the FA Cup semi-finals in 1979, that required a replay at Hillsborough. You had the replay at Main Road in 85 as well, and there have been some other pretty unforgettable ties, maybe for the wrong reasons, at Anfield this century in 2006 with Alan Smith's broken ankle and the horrific scenes that he had. And then in 2012 you had the return of Patrice Evra to Anfield about a month after Liverpool wore those T-shirts in support of Luis Suarez after he racially abused him, and Evra staggeringly got booed that day. Liverpool won, but it almost felt like an afterthought because of the way the club were continuing to conduct themselves at that time. Fortunately, I think it took far too long, but I think belatedly they realised they were in the wrong of the way they went about that whole affair. But in terms of, you know, looking at it from a contemporary perspective, as you say, there is a hell of a lot riding on this game. I mean, there was a hell of a lot riding on the FA Cup final last season when United had City, and it was a chance for United to have, I think United were guaranteed to have a good season. Had they won the FA Cup, they'd have had a great season, winning the two domestic cups, getting back into the Champions League. It was a chance to scupper City's treble. They were unable to do that. This is a chance to scupper Klopp's, a quadruple for Klopp. Liverpool are in the running, obviously, for the title, and they're all but through to the Europa League quarterfinals as well after thrashing Sparta Prague last week. And from United's perspective, although there is that incentive, I think that's going to be more of an incentive for the supporters than the players and the manager. They can still have a good successful season, and in order to have a successful season, they absolutely have to win the FA Cup, because it's the last possible piece of silverware that they can win. And look, they've not won the FA Cup anywhere near as often as they should have done in the last 20 years. It's peculiar that May will mark the 20th anniversary of their FA Cup win against Millwall, which was one of the most one-sided finals that there's ever been in the competition. But they've only won it once since, and there's almost been a bit of a curse about they've struggled with this curse in the FA Cup almost. I think they've lost four of the last FA Cup finals they've been involved in. And looking at some of those games, certainly the Arsenal one in 2005, that stung, given how dominant they were that day. The first ever final at the new Wembley was a very forgettable game when they lost to Chelsea. And then there was another forgettable game against Chelsea 11 years later when they lost 1-0 to an Eden Hazard penalty. And then, of course, you had last year's final against City, which was certainly the most hyped FA Cup final this century, I would think. But in terms of the weekend's game, just when you've got 9,000 Scousers at Old Trafford and you're a game away from Wembley, and I think we both agree that FA Cup semi-finals should not be at Wembley, but when you frame it like that, it does make this occasion sound a lot more significant. And it is an occasion as well. It's not just a cup tie this weekend or a fixture. This is an occasion when it's Manchester United against Liverpool in the FA Cup.
Yeah, hopefully the semi-finals will be at the Wembley of the North in the future, in years to come. It is the start of a huge run for United, really. Like you say, still in the cup, get through this weekend, a semi-final, potential final to look through. Still in with a chance of the Champions League after last weekend's results going for them. They went for a team bonding meal in Manchester on Wednesday night, which you've done the story on this morning. Probably a good time to kind of get a bit of unity together, and also boosted by some players returning to training this week. Aaron Wan-Bissaka's been pictured on the grass in first team training, and Mason Mount finally back in training as well. I guess there's more intrigue over Mount's return. He's not played since November the 11th. He had a very slow start to his United career. He's now been out for 5 months with kind of various setbacks, really. I think he's been back in training once already and then had another setback. It's been a long road to return. Maybe he'll be in the matchday squad this week. But even going forward, I mean, how do you see his role for the rest of the season? And can he actually get back in this team?
Well, it will be difficult for him because he's been usurped by Kobbie Mainoo. He's not going to shift Bruno Fernandes anytime soon. There's an outside chance that Mount and Fernandes could be accommodated in the same front four, which was something that Ten Hag wanted to trial during pre-season. But unfortunately, that lasted less than 2 minutes because Mainoo went off injured in terms of with his preferred pick of players. But of course, Mount and Fernandes did have a foolish game in that system with Fernandes on the right and Mount behind. It must have been Marcus Rashford that evening against Real Madrid. But it's only a friendly, and that's literally the only time they've, you know, really had, I think maybe against Brentford. That was possibly the only other game. That was the only competitive game, and that was the last time Mount started in the Premier League. And you're going back to October the 7th for that, and he was really poor that day. He'd shown a couple of signs that maybe he was building momentum. He was very good for a half against Palace in the League Cup, but it was Palace in the League Cup. Palace hit the eject button themselves that night, and I thought he was reasonably okay in the home defeat to Galatasaray. And at the time, there was a bit of a debate as to, well, should he move to the right flank, because there's clearly an imbalance in midfield there. Him and Casemiro's looked a mismatch, and it was. Sure. And then he didn't fare well at all on the right-hand side against Brentford. And as I said, he's not started in the Premier League since. I think his only start for United since that day was in the League Cup defeat to Newcastle. So I think he would have to do an awful lot over the next 2 months for this season not to be the write-off that it looks, really. As you said, he's missed 5 months of the campaign. When United confirmed his return to training in the week, they played all the hits. It was one of the most decorated young English players. I don't think he really constitutes as young anymore. He's 25 now. He has won the Champions League. He is an England international. He has started in a Euros final. He started in FA Cup finals, League Cup final, of course. He's got a wealth of experience, but it doesn't really count for a lot when you're on the sidelines for as long as he has been this season. And he was on the sidelines for a long time last season. And the reason why there's a lot of scrutiny on him, a lot of criticism, not of him as much as United, is because that when he last year, of course, he'd entered the final year of his contract at Chelsea, and United parted with £55 million up front to sign someone who, at the time of speaking, has played 12 games this season, and he's got one assist in those 12 games. He's not started, I think he started four times in the league. He's obviously had injury issues, as he had last season, so it really has been a questionable piece of business. And of course, there was interest from Arsenal and Liverpool last season, and I think United were quite happy to get it out there. There was reputed chatter that Arteta was telling confidants that he thought it was all but a done deal to sign Mason Mount, and that Liverpool had touched base via Jurgen Klopp as well. And I actually think Mount would have been much more aligned and much more of a better fit to go into Liverpool side than United side. I think the quizzical thing about United signing Mount was that they just saw him as a central midfielder. And the word coming out from the club was that the scouts were aligned with Ten Hag. And if you're a scout who's worth their salt, I would have thought someone would have raised their hand and said, actually, he's not, you're taking a bit of a risk here to spend 50 odd million pounds on someone and try and, you know, make him transform him or reinvent him as a deep line midfielder. Certainly as his starting position, obviously his off the ball work is very laudable, and you want to maximise his pressing as much as possible. And if you've got Hoyland, Fernandez and Mount potentially, you know, at the forefront of pressing, then that could come off, and maybe that will in time be vindicated, and the signing of Mount will be vindicated. But when you look at what has happened this season, you can't just say it's all bad luck and it was just a luckless judgment call. He did have injuries last season. Okay, another club certainly were going to sign him, I think, in the summer, and maybe the same fate would have befallen Liverpool or Arsenal if they'd signed Mason Mount. They'd have only been able to play him 12 times by now. But when he was fit, he was dropped. He was dropped after the Brentford game in October. And as I said, he only started again in the League Cup tie. I vividly remember when we went to Fulham, I think it was Rich and myself, he came on and there was a very simple pass to play the first time he got the ball, and he failed to play it. And Bruno Fernandes, who's normally, everyone knows, he's not shy of berating a teammate. Rather than berate Mount, he applauded him. He tried to encourage him. And that gives you an idea as to, I suppose, not just the character of the player, but the difficult time that he was having at that time as well. This was just the first few days of November, and he'd had a bad start to his United career, and clearly there were players there who were trying to G him up and encourage him. But unfortunately, the next week or a couple of weeks later, whenever it was, he got injured again, and he's not played since. So there's, you know, the fault lies a lot on the at the feet of the club, because I've been quite consistent in saying it. I think when you look at the need, again, the need for a midfielder at United, and you look at the midfielders who've elite midfielders or midfielders who've developed into elite midfielders in recent years, United have had some interest or concrete interest, or, you know, that there've been conversations with most of them, whether it was Moises Caicedo, Declan Rice, Aurelien Tchouameni, Eduardo Camavinga, Jude Bellingham, and all these players have slipped the net. And you can't always just say, oh, well, Jude Bellingham wanted minutes, so he went to Dortmund, or Camavinga always wanted to play in Spain. Declan Rice should have been a Manchester United player. If they had, the funds, if they were that intent on signing a midfielder, I think Declan Rice would have ended up at United. Yeah. And instead, they've signed a midfielder who not many people regard as an out-and-out central midfielder. And it has shown from the word go this season, in that first game against Wolves, when Casemiro was exposed and Wolves somehow didn't get a point at Old Trafford, when they would have well been worth one, and they should have had a penalty right at the death. But the way United was set up with Mount and Casemiro, it's just always looked like a mismatch. And unfortunately for Mount, he's another player who's received the number seven shirt, and the curse has still not been lifted. He's had a worse start as a number seven for Manchester United than Memphis Depay, Angel Di Maria, Alexis Sanchez and Michael Owen. And it's only probably by virtue of his injury issues that he will last longer than Di Maria and Sanchez as well, almost certainly. Di Maria only lasted a season because he never really wanted to be in Manchester. Sanchez was there for, what, 18 months, I think it was. And United were very, very keen to cut their losses of him. But with Mount, I think it's safe to assume that he will get a second season at United. But how he fits in will be, you know, it would be fascinating to monitor that, because there's a chance that there will be a change of manager as well at United ahead of next season. And then what does that say for his future? I mean, obviously, I don't think Thomas Tuchel will end up at United next season, but that would be the best case scenario for Mount if there was a managerial change, because Tuchel loved him at Chelsea and they had a very good working relationship there, and Mount's career highlights came under Tuchel. But I think the stars would have to align for him to become a success at United now. It's very rare that a player at Manchester United in living memory has a first season as chasing as Mason Mount has and goes on to be a success. There are examples, of course, but it's not like Manchester City, where almost the first season for a new signing, it's kind of like, however tepid they are, it's just dismissed because they end up winning a big trophy anyway. And then the second season, the player is settled in and he's transformed. It's happened so often at City, but United, they don't have that environment. It really is sink or swim. It's black and white. It's black or white, sorry. Whereas at City, there's a lot more nuance to it, and they've got a hell of a supporting cast to assist new players coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I compared Mount with Kai Havertz early in the season that Arteta and Ten Hag had basically signed both of those players to play in midfield when they hadn't played there for years. And Arsenal started to get a tune out of Havertz by basically playing him where he played for Chelsea. And maybe United will have to come to the same decision with Mount. And the only way they're going to make it a success is by finding a role for him in the front three. But talking of the front three, one player who the one manager has told us he will be available this weekend is Rasmus Højlund. The Denmark manager seems pretty certain he's going to play. Mm. He's not been seen back in training yet. He was at Carrington yesterday, but it was an afternoon training session and he turned up first thing in the morning, which would suggest he's doing rehab work rather than training. We've not seen any images or video from full training yesterday, and it sounded like there was a doubt whether he was going to participate in that session, and it might have just been sort of rehab work. If that is the case, he's cutting it fine if he is going to be involved this weekend. I mean, he's not been out for long. I think it was due to be a three-week absence. 3 weeks would be this weekend. But no matter what Caspi Hullmand has said, it's probably still not a guarantee that Rasmus Højlund is going to start this game yet, is it?
No, I think we'll probably be waiting until 1:15 tomorrow for Ten Hag's press conference for clarification on that. And then United will still have another training session on the Saturday before the Sunday game. So they've still got but when Ten Hag speaks to us tomorrow, there'll still be 48 hours to go until more than 40, in fact, 50 hours really? Pretty much until kickoff. So that's a long, long time to still, wait it out and see what materializes. Or Hoyland has, he's recovered and he's fine and he's had a session that day or he's had a session today. I'm not too sure what the days off Rota was this week. So I think the assumption going into the week was that the press conference would be today and then Friday would be a day off. There's been a change there because in recent weeks when United have had a Sunday game, there've been press conferences on the Thursday because Friday's been allocated as a day off for the players, but clearly that's not the case this week because we'll be at Carrington tomorrow. But that's the big one. I mean, I think with Wan-Bissaka, I think it is in their interests for him to be available and to even start on Sunday, because I just think United would benefit from having his athleticism in the back four and also having two fullbacks, even though it would be two right backs. I mean, the last time Dalot and Wan-Bissaka played together, Wan-Bissaka was on the left and Dalot was on the right. Because I think, someone might have pulled out that morning. I think Luke Shaw was due to play and then he couldn't play. So in the end, rather than change Dalot's role, it was just putting Wan-Bissaka in. And you wouldn't necessarily say that's advised going with Wan-Bissaka on the left, but certainly there's a possibility that if it's Lindelof and Evans or Lindelof and Maguire on that left side of defence, if Maguire is indeed fit, that there's not a lot of pace there. And I think it's safe to assume that Liverpool, given that their regulars will be able to have a breather in the second leg against Sparta Prague this evening, that it will be Nunez, Diaz and Salah. And you can't have a really, really slow defence. And look, Varane isn't as quick as he used to be. And I think there are times when he almost runs within himself because he doesn't want to break down. He doesn't want to risk an injury there. So it's in United's interest, I think, to have Wan-Bissaka in that team, whether it's right back or left back, who knows. But I think the prospect of Lindelof and Evans is asking for trouble there. They need to have a bit more pace available there against Nunez, Salah and Diaz, as I said. But Hoyland is the real big one because they need a focal point. They have struggled for goals since Hoyland got injured. You look at the manner of the goals and the identity of the goal scorers. It was Maguire, a centre-back against Fulham. It was Casemiro, defensive midfielder against Forest. Rashford scored the goal of his life at City. And then last week, it's two penalties in a game that Everton had a lot of attempts at goal and United were pretty uninspiring going forward, even though they had the odd opportunity outside the penalties. But that just gives you an idea that it's really not complicated. When United have had a striker in form this season, they've been winning games, not necessarily convincing with those performances, but they've not struggled for goals. When the striker comes out of the team, they are struggling for goals. And I know that Ten Hag will say, well, we've scored in every one and we had chances here, chances there, but they're also giving up a lot of chances as well. And Andre Onana's goal is being peppered with shots still, even by a team in Everton who you never have any faith that they're going to score whenever they venture forward. And that was certainly the case on Saturday. They never looked like they were convinced that they were going to go 1-0 up or make it 1-1 or make it 2-1. That's what made it such a stayed fixture, really, as did the lunchtime scheduling of it. But Hoyland, as I said, it's United season possibly could be defined by his injury, because of course when he got injured, they lost to Fulham the next day, and that was a real blow. That, given how well February was going for them, having won all their games, to have lost the Fulham game, and then next week they lost rather expectedly at City. But if they'd beaten Fulham, I don't think there would be this pessimism over their top four chances, particularly given that Villa have been prone to a few wobbles over the last few months, and Tottenham a serial bottle job. So as I said on Monday, I think it would be particularly galling if United were to finish below both those teams. But I also wouldn't cite Hoyland getting injured as an excuse, because it's United's fault that they failed to sell Anthony Marshall all those years ago, and it's their fault that they've not been proactive in trying to shift Marshall on Ten Hag's watch and getting a proper backup striker in, because you know it's no one's fault but Ten Hag's that they decided to choose Wout Weghorst last year, and Weghorst was just he was literally a body, really. There was very little about him as a striker that was noteworthy or skillful. His two goals were tap-ins, and he only played as often as he did because, again, Marshall was injured.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all for part one of the Manchester United podcast. We'll be back after the break to have a little look at United's latest financial results.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome back to the Manchester is Red podcast. Samuel, you said before that the FA Cup is the only trophy still available to United this season. Arsene Wenger would probably disagree with you on that front. They could still get fourth, which is as good as a trophy. At least it was in that era for Wenger at Arsenal when they were so desperate to stay in the Champions League and fund their new stadium. And United's financial results this week, just for the 3 months, that essentially incorporated the Champions League group stage, I think October, November, December, up to December the 31st, the results were four. I mean, there's never a huge amount of takeaways from financial results that only incorporate 3 months. But on this occasion, you know, as I kind of said yesterday, the good news in the results was also the bad news, that their revenues are up significantly, but they're up because of the Champions League. And it ain't looking good for the Champions League next season, is it? It just shows how valuable that competition is to a club like United.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the obvious takeaway from these quarterly results at this time of year. If it's touch and go with top four or possibly top five this season, with the Premier League and you know, the fifth place side possibly getting into the Champions League via the cap flap more than the back door, I would say. And yeah, there used to be a sense of a minor sense of occasion. They were almost a bit of an event, these conference, these quarterly results, yeah. Because you used to have the conference calls, but there hasn't been one in probably 18 months now. There certainly hasn't been one since the strategic review. I think it's probably September 2022, but they were a hell of a lot more entertaining when it was Ed Woodward on them. And it was tone deaf central. There was one point where the new director of communications, when he came in, Charlie Brooks, in 2018, he changed the scripts that Woodward would speak only on football matters rather than the app rating or, you know, which noodle partner could they get next. And instead they threw Richard Arnold under the bus and he could brag about the how many downloads the app had and how they've got more followers on Facebook than the NFL, the NBA and the MLB or whatever it was combined. I think that was one of the highlights. And even on the press release that comes out, it used to say highlights and now it says key points, because let's face it, if you're listing, you know, we loaned out 11 players in January or whatever it was as a highlight, then it's open to ridicule. So they have adjusted the script, and they have got someone into give the press release a more thorough subbing with maybe a more of a fan-centric hat on as well, just to, you know, bear in mind what supporters will make of the perception of United, you know, trumpeting these achievements in their eyes as highlights. But it's, you know, this is the invidious position United are in the Champions League. Many years ago, probably 11 years ago, the Champions League qualification was secured before a ball had been kicked in August. You just knew that United would be in the Champions League every season, season after season after season. And after they appointed David Moyes, that was no longer the case. They appointed an Everton manager and got Evertonian standards in that season when they finished, was it seventh, I think it was, in the end, because they didn't even qualify for Europe. They didn't have any European football in 2014-15. And their pedigree in the Champions League since has been dismal. They've got to, the quarterfinals once since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. I think they've only been to the quarterfinals, is it twice? It's twice since Ferguson retired and twice since they got to the final in 2011. And they were under Moyes in 2014 and Solskjaer in 2019. And in the end, they were quite soundly beaten in both of those ties, more so the Barcelona one in 2019, in Munich in 2014. Of course, they went 1-0 up and they were ahead in the tie at Old Trafford and then at the Allianz Arena. And Bayern had to rally quite late on to win the second leg 3-1. But I think part of the issue I have with United in the Champions League is that, yes, okay, it's important to get into it, and they've done that. And there's been a feel-good factor when they have achieved it, and when they did achieve it in 2020, because they did it on the final day at Leicester. And then, of course, they did it last season in the penultimate game of the season against Chelsea at Old Trafford. And it almost felt like the good times are back here for United. But after they did that, in both those, in the next season, they went out of the group stage. And I know it's important getting the revenue in the group stage and having the match day revenue, but a club like Manchester United, who were the first English club to enter the European Cup in the 50s, to be going out of the group stage as often as they have done is quite risible, really. And it's happened, four times, I think, since they got to the final in 2011. It happened at the end of the year in 2011, in Ferguson's penultimate season. It happened under Van Gaal, happened under Solskjaer, and it's happened under Ten Hag as well. And as I said, they hardly ever get to the quarterfinals. Their knockout record, if you were to lay it out in European competition, or certainly the Champions League, it would not be very, very long at all. There's that one highlight of that night in Paris under Solskjaer, which was extraordinary and absolute privilege to be at, like a really, really special night in the modern history of United. But they've not kicked on from there whatsoever. They got to the quarterfinals, they got thumped 4-0 in the quarterfinals by Barcelona, and they've not been back to the quarterfinals of the Champions League since. And when they did get to a European final the other year in the Europa League, it was only because they'd dropped out of the Champions League at the group stage last season. I thought that was a massive missed opportunity in the Europa League when they drew a really poor Sevilla side at that time. But Sevilla being Sevilla, they love the Europa League so much, they decided to play out their skins and batter United 3-0 in the second leg and go on and win the competition. But the European pedigree of United, it's lacking. And maybe as damaging as it would be for the finances and profitability and sustainability rules, but maybe they just need a reality check, and they need a jolt that just being in the Champions League is not good enough, because that is the culture that the Glazer family have settled for over the last decade. It's just get in the Champions League. It doesn't matter what you do in the Champions League, just we have to be in it. And of course, they set that precedent by sacking two managers because they didn't get top four. And the other two managers they sacked, that happened, those dismissals occurred in seasons where they also didn't finish in the top four. So that's the culture that they've set. They need to eradicate that culture. They need to get away from it. I agree that, you know, it's still a manager's future, not necessarily hinge on whether you get in the top four. It goes beyond that. And I think with Ten Hag this season, the issues do go beyond the fact that they are sixth in the table. There's no style of play. They've lost a lot of games. They're off the pace in the Premier League compared to last season. You know, if you were to do a graph of the comparison of the trajectories between the two seasons, they would look wildly different. And there are, as I said, there are a lot of issues beyond them not being or them not occupying a top four place at the moment. But of course, it has a massive bearing on a manager's position at Manchester United. And I think it should do. But as I said, you've got to look at the bigger picture. And the style is an issue. The signings are an issue. The lack of a trophy would be an issue if they don't get that as well. There would be an argument that if they were to get, because as much as I'd love to see United go on a winning run, because it'd be great for us to, you know, have a sustained period of positivity and win all their remaining 10 games and get in the top four. I just don't think they've got it in them to finish above Spurs and Villa. And if they do, they'd have to have a huge help in hand from both of those clubs in the running. And they've got to be ruthless enough to capitalise on it. And does anybody realistically think they have it in them? There's been scant evidence of that so far this season. So if they had a hell of a run in, then, you know, fair dues to them and they'll have pulled it off. But I think there's a very slim chance of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, that win in Paris was 5 years ago last week, one of two knockout ties they've won in 11 years in the Champions League. It is a wretched record. I mean, those figures showed that matchday and broadcast revenue just for the group stage alone was up 65 million compared to the Europa League group stage the year before. When you throw in prize money and hopefully 1 year actually getting out of the groups, it's probably £100 million plus swing between beating the Europa League and the Champions League. And at a time when United need to spend on the squad, quite clearly there's going to be a big churn, when Sir Jim Ratcliffe talking about building a new stadium, it's a dangerous time to be dropping out of that kind of top table, isn't it? We've seen with Newcastle that they've got all the money in the world, but they just can't spend it because the Premier League spending rules, and it can become kind of a self-fulfilling cycle, I guess, that if you miss out on the Champions League, you can't spend the money required to get back in the Champions League, and then you miss out again and you can't spend it again. And the Glazers' response to missing out on the Champions League used to be to spend more in a transfer window, wasn't it? Yeah. And now it feels like Ineos can't do that. That these spending rules are so tight that if United miss out on the Champions League, they probably can't spend A, what they want to, and B, what they need to. And it is, you know, the danger of missing out, I think, is much greater than it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, when the Glazers would just dig a little deeper in their pockets, look behind the sofa and find money for a bigger transfer window.
I think it's inevitable there will be a backlash at some point against it, because although I think the essence of profitability and sustainability rules is positive and reining in spending is advisable. I mean, it was that clubs got a lot of flack, and in fairness to City, I think it was Omar Berada, in fact, who did the on-the-record interview with our colleague Cy Bykowski in late 2020, because people were reeling from the COVID-19 pandemic, whether it was their health or whether it was their wealth as well, in terms of the economic hit that people were suffering, and people being on furlough, not being able to go about their normal day job, and how detrimental that was to a lot of people's mental health. You had football clubs spending hundreds of millions still. I think City did break the £100 million barrier, and I think Solskjaer got a little bit of flack for saying, I can't remember what the quote was, but he said, like, he might have been capitalised. They had to capitalise on clubs who might have had to sell players because of the pandemic. And I think he had a bit of a climb down from that, because somebody suggested to him that, you know, maybe not the best turn of phrase given the climate at the time. I wasn't too offended by it at all. I think he was talking a good game, and if you're a Manchester United manager, you do need to sound bullish. But they have some of the spending in recent years is obscene, and as I said, in essence, I think FFP it has merit, but the execution of it at times, when you've got a situation at Chelsea and United could find themselves in a similar situation with some of their players in the summer, where you've got a homegrown academy product who is clearly very important to the manager, in Conor Gallagher, and he's starting every game pretty much, and the manager values him, and the manager would keep him at pretty much all costs, it feels like, at the moment. But he is being touted for a possible move because he would represent a pure profit, and that's one of the flaws. These rules shouldn't be designed whereby there's pressure on clubs to be getting rid of homegrown players who they would never ordinarily consider getting rid of. You look at United, there were two glaring examples there in Rashford and McTominay. Now, there are reasons to get to sell both beyond profitability and sustainability rules in the summer. But if those rules didn't exist, there would certainly not be anywhere near as much noise about the possibility of either of them going. That the likelihood, and it still could be the case, that McTominay gets a new contract rather than is sold. But when we're looking and assessing players' futures now and what Ineos might be looking to do, you have to factor in PSR, because if you're getting, I mean, with Rashford and McTominay, ideally, you'd be looking to fetch well north of the £100 million for those two. That's a hell of a lot of money to generate for just two sales in a summer where there are question marks hovering over several players' futures in that United squad. As I said, I think there are at least 21 players who you cannot say for certain that they're going to be at the club next season. Now, they're not going to get rid of all of those players. That would be almost unprecedented. I don't think even Nottingham Forest could manage that after all the players they brought in the other summer. But you can see separately why these individual players might not be at the club next season. And with a couple of them, as I said, in Rashford and McTominay, PSR comes into it. So it's an interesting time to take over a football club, because you can't do what Roman Abramovich did in 2003, and you can't do what the Abu Dhabi group did in 2008 and beyond. And look, City have reined in spending a little bit more, but they have also still spent a substantial amount. I mean, Jack Grealish cost £100 million. There was a period at City where they liked to tell the world that they'd never spent more than 60 million for a player or something like that, which was, I think, one that just, you know, highlighted how brilliant their recruitment was. And when you get in a player like Rodri for about 60 million pounds or whatever it was that he cost, and what a great player he's turned out to be for City, that is just great recruitment. They did spend an awful lot to get to where they are. Of course, they broke the transfer record for a goalkeeper in Edison, the record for a fullback as well. I think Grealish became the first £100 million player in England. But City are very, you know, obviously they've got the 115 charges to answer to, and whenever that process is eventually concluded. But it's not like City in 2008, when they were just trying to sign anyone who was available, or 2009, where they went on a big spending splurge and they were looking to flex their muscles, and understandably so at that time, because they were the upstarts and they were trying to upset the elite in English football. But you can't do that now, and Ineos certainly can't do it as well. And that's why it's particularly imperative United do not go down the route of spending or investing €100 million in a winger who's one-paced, one-dimensional, and has one trick. Sure. After just playing 2 years in Amsterdam.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all for part two. We'll be back after the break to look ahead in a little more detail to the Liverpool game. Welcome back to the Manchester Race Red podcast. So as we said at the top of the show, Liverpool in the FA Cup quarterfinal this weekend, a huge, huge fixture. Some minor team news dilemmas, I guess, for Erik ten Hag, with a few players returning this week. Obviously, we'll find out more at his press conference with regards to the availability of Rasmus Højlund. One of our colleagues has just mentioned, actually, that Johnny Evans isn't in the Northern Ireland squad for the international breaks, and one of the papers over there is reporting that that's because of a knock. Obviously, there's been nothing mentioned at United, and he has been playing recently, so that might be further team news to look into on Friday at ten Hag's press conference. But Samuel, based on what we do know at the moment, what are you expecting from the team? Probably not a lot of changes, I guess. And what would you do personally? Is there any sort of thing, anything you'd look at and think that needs changing at the moment?
Well, if Højlund's fit, then he has to start. As I said earlier, I think with the defence, there are a few dilemmas there. Do you go with two full-backs, or do you stick with the auxiliary option in Lindelof at centre half if Evans is out? then logically it would be Maguire. If Maguire is fit, because there's a question mark over him, it's not been confirmed if he's going to be available this weekend. If he's not available, then it has to be Lindelof at centre half. So there are a lot of, it's, you know, if Ten Hag clearly knows more than we do, because he's at Carrington, and Gary O'Driscoll is informing him and keeping him abreast of the fitness issues and the possible return dates of injured players. But it wouldn't surprise me if he's looking at his team at the start of the week looks different on Sunday, just because of, you know, this player might be available, that player might not be available. I'd have probably with Evans, it would help if Northern Ireland confirmed if he was if he was totally out for this weekend, but it would indicate that he is if he's not going to be linking up with them for the March internationals. I'd have probably gone with him as a starter, just because he's in good form, and he started the last two games. He's played very well in both of them. He'll have had an 8-day breather, but all of that is moot if he's actually injured and he's got a knock. And of course, he's not in the Northern Ireland squad, so then your plans have to change, and a line goes through his name, and then it's possibly Lindelof's name scribbled down or Maguire's name scribbled down. And then if it's Lindelof's name and Maguire's unavailable, then it has to be Wan-Bissaka starting on Sunday. But as I said, I'd go with Wan-Bissaka regardless, because they need athleticism in that back four. And I think the fact that they may well try and get rid of Wan-Bissaka in the summer is moot. Fred starts in the FA Cup final, and by then it was a well-established fact that there was a possibility that he was going to be sold in the summer, and he was to Fenerbahce. So while these players are under contract and available for selection, and they have a purpose in the team, you've got to play them. There's no point leaving them by the roadside.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting to hear Ten Hag talk after the Everton win about how unconcerned he seemed with his team facing 198 shots in 10 games, and talking about low quality chances. I mean, it's been a huge debating point this week, the number of shots United face and whether it's a concern or not. I mean, it quite clearly has to be a concern, as much as Ten Hag might play it down. And it's going to be an interesting one this weekend, because you've got a team who, you know, only Sheffield United have had more shots on their goal than United this season. Liverpool have taken more shots than anyone else in the Premier League. They had 34 at Anfield against United, but didn't actually score, and that game finished with Klopp praising United's defending. I mean, it's kind of a clash of styles, I guess, in a strange juxtaposition, but I think we all expect Liverpool to rack up the shots at Old Trafford. They're probably going to have 20-plus shots, at least, you would imagine, because that's what they tend to do, and that's what United tend to allow. Ten Hag was talking about defending in a low block because he hasn't got pacey defenders, so that's what they prefer to do. And it does feel, if United are to win this game, it's going to rely on Andre Onana making some saves, and those centre-backs, whoever they are, making a lot of blocks.
It would take monumental effort to win the game. They did it against Liverpool last season in Ten Hag's first win, and you when you look at the three performances against Liverpool under Ten Hag, I mean, they've been so varied. As I said, that night they overwhelmed Liverpool, and nobody really expected that. Liverpool had an iffy start to the season against Fulham and Palace, drawing those two games. But this was a team that was still unbeaten in domestic competition that calendar year. They'd reached the Champions League final. They were they'd won the two domestic cups the previous season, and they'd taken the title race to the wire as well. They were, and still are, a formidable team, and United pull one out of the hat that night. Then you had the Anfield annihilation just over a year ago, and United played quite well in the first half, and I think there was quite a bullish mood about among United supporters at half-time. Then they conceded six goals in 45 minutes, and that bullish mood had changed rather drastically. And in December, I myself included, I think most people thought it was a question of how many United would lose by. And they got a very creditable draw, and they probably had the best chance as well for Rasmus Højlund. They had another good opportunity for Garnacho, but he, as he still tends to do when in a shooting position, he didn't get a shot off, unfortunately for him. So they managed that game very well in December, and there was certainly some spirit about them that day. This weekend, they will have a stronger team than they did at Anfield a few months ago. They'll have the backing of the Old Trafford natives as well. It'll be a febrile atmosphere, I'm sure. I hope it will be a febrile atmosphere. I mean, it should be when it's United, Liverpool and the FA Cup at Old Trafford, and you've got, as I said earlier, 9,000 Scousers there to really amplify the noise and ensure that there's a hell of a lot of repartee, to put it politely, shall we say, between both sets of supporters. And United need to feed off that. And when you look at their possible lineup this weekend, it's actually not far off their strongest 11. You'd probably put certainly Luke Shaw in it and Lisandro Martinez in it. But other than that, there's a possibility that they'll have nine of their first team are starting. So that's not a bad place to be in when you're about to come up against, as I said, one of the most formidable teams in world football, and a team that is trying to have as good an end to the season as possible for Jurgen Klopp, and as he embarks on his farewell tour. So I don't think that going into this game, certainly the mood compared to the last time the two teams played against each other at Old Trafford, there's certainly not an air of resignation about United going into it. Going into that match, it was only 9 days earlier that they'd had the generational nadir at Brentford, and there was a particularly ferocious atmosphere that evening. I think it had just emerged as well that Jim Ratcliffe had declared interest in taking over the club. There were the protests outside the stadium. It was a balmy night. Liverpool were in town. United had lost quite badly in their first two games of the season after having their worst season in decades. And they just channeled all of that negativity into this extraordinarily positive performance where they were deserved winners. It was a turning point for a number of people that night. I mean, Martinez was phenomenal. Ten Hag got his first win. Not a turning point for Jadon Sancho, but when he scored, I still think that's the loudest that I've ever heard Old Trafford. And it's a shame that when you watch it back on YouTube, the roar that greets that goal is completely ruined by the celebratory shriek from Gary Neville on that Fan Zone co-commentary with Jamie Carragher. So fortunately, viewers won't have that this weekend. It's on ITV, and I'm sure that there were some listeners who were probably thinking, oh, that's even worse than Sky Sports. But that atmosphere last season, it was unforgettable. It was certainly one of the most memorable games I've covered at Old Trafford in press. And going a little bit back in time to when I was in the press box at Old Trafford, I suppose from a Liverpool perspective, if you're seeking an omen, this weekend does mark the 10th anniversary of the infamous 3-0 United defeat to Liverpool under David Moyes. And that it wasn't just one nail in Moyes' coffin that day. There were a few more hammered in that had already, I think the hierarchy had already started to turn at that point. The first leg against Midtjylland in the Champions League signaled that. And then there were a couple of more dreadful results to endure before Moyes got the bullet.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't put you on the spot for a prediction then, but how big or how small a chance are you giving United of pulling it off and being in that semi-final? Well, I don't know where the semi-final draw is. They might be in it anyway, but being in the actual semi-finals.
I think they've got a reasonable chance. I certainly, Everton last week, it's almost as if the opponent bring your own levels down. It's not an excuse, but that's just what naturally happens from time to time. And with this weekend, if those players can't get themselves up for Liverpool at home in an FA Cup quarter final, then they shouldn't be there. And I don't think that will be the case. You'll see just by the probable starters that all of them will be motivated. People have, myself included, have questioned Rashford's body language this season. It's not been good enough at times, but his body language, his commitment, and his performance level in the past couple of games have been fine. They've been decent. He's back among the goals, so he's going into the game in reasonable form. Varane has had a long starting run. Dallow's not got injured all season. He's a certain starter. Anana's starting to look at ease in Manchester United colours. I think Casemiro is probably the worry, not in terms of his commitment or his attitude, but certainly he's very poor against Everton last week, and he's had a poor season. And he was the night he was unveiled, of course, when United beat Liverpool at Old Trafford. So he's not experienced United Liverpool at Old Trafford yet. He was a starter in the Anfield annihilation last year. But that it'll be interesting to see how they cope in midfield, because Liverpool, I think one of the reasons why Liverpool struggled against United in December was that they didn't have a creative fulcrum in that midfield really underpinning the attacks. When Liverpool have beaten United before at Anfield in recent years, I've come away from the games and the midfielder has stood out as the man of the match. Thiago in 2022 when they won 4-0, Fabinho in 2018 in Mourinho's last game, Jordan Henderson in the January 2020 game. So I think that's three of their last four wins against United at Anfield. I've looked at it and come away thinking like it's a midfielder who's been the linchpin, even though it's been Salah or whoever else who's got the goals. There's been a midfielder who's had a huge, huge bearing on the outcome of that game, whether they've won quite a tight contest 2-0, whether they've absolutely pummeled United 7-0. Not 7-0, sorry, 4-0 in the case of the Thiago game. The game last season was just, it was bizarre that United, who haven't won a cup a week earlier, sieved seven goals in probably, when did Cody Gakpo score? It was 30-something minute, I think. Probably not even within an hour of football to Liverpool. It was just, it was stuff that you'd probably see on a school field during a lunchtime kickabout. So it was, I think, you not to dismiss that game from last season, but certainly the games where there was the scoreline wasn't quite as chasing for United, the midfielder was key to Liverpool. And I think that's going to be an area of interest this weekend, because Liverpool, obviously, the way they played against City at the weekend, again, I thought McAllister was very good, and there's a chance he'll have a big role to play this weekend. And Liverpool have got a breather tonight against Sparta Prague. So how Casemiro and Kobbie Mainoo fare will be really, really interesting. And I thought they actually did reasonably well against City, but I thought that day it was almost as if Mainoo was playing within himself. He took a back seat so that Casemiro wouldn't be as exposed. And I thought Casemiro was relatively decent until, come the final 10 minutes, City just took the game away from United.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, enjoy the game, Samuel, and stick with us on the MEN over the weekend for all of our coverage. You'll be there with Stephen this weekend. I'm on a stag do, so I'll be watching it in the pub with a beer in hand and reading the MEN blog for your insights from the ground, of course, as I always do when I'm not at the game. But enjoy it, and we'll be back on Monday to dissect it in a bit more detail, and hopefully a positive outcome and a positive show. Also, just to mention that we have, or Reach rather, have launched the Podcast Awards, which I'm sure you can imagine already what that is. Basically, the finest goals, the best goals scored in amateur football around the country. So if you've filmed any Sunday morning worldies or pub team belters, then get them submitted. There's a prize for the best goals in the Podcast Awards. There's no FIFA ceremony, but there are cash prizes to be won. Closes at 6 p.m. on May the 19th. So 6 p.m. 6 p.m. Sunday, May the 19th. So plenty of time to get them submitted. There's a link in the description to this podcast, or just search Podcast Awards. I'm sure Google will try and auto-correct you, but you know what you're looking for, of course. And you can get your entries submitted there. But that's all for today. We'll be back on Monday. But thanks for tuning in, and do give us a like and a subscribe as usual.